It is well accepted that Jaws is an all-time great film, but its progeny don't rank nearly as high. Two True Freaks is proud to present Is It Jaws, where Paul Spitero and Sean Whalen are joined by an all-star list of guest hosts to review old and new films and place them on the Jaws scale, where they're ranked from Jaws to Jaws 4. Of course, for the purposes of the show, that scale does take some liberties with their actual ratings. Sure, movies that are given the ranking of Jaws are considered classic films with few flaws, if any. A ranking of Jaws 2 indicates that the film is very good and worthy of repeated viewings. A Jaws 3 ranking indicates the film was okay, but that's all. A Jaws 4 means it's ranked as a bad movie. Oh, and if you ever saw Back to the Future Part 2, you know that there's a Jaws 19. That ranking indicates that the movie is so incredibly bad that it's actually fun to watch as a result. So please join Paul and Sean as they ask the ever-important question, is it Jaws?
Magic mirror on the wall. Who is the fairest one of all?
Everybody, and welcome to Is It Jaws? I'm Paul Spitero, and as usual, I am here with my good friend, Mr. Sean Whalen.
It is an absolute pleasure to be here, as always.
And it is an animated pleasure to have you here. And we are joined today as we start a new project with Mr. Scott Gardner.
Hello!
How you doing?
I'm doing great. I'm very excited for this, and I'm very honored to be invited on for it.
Well, you're going to be the regular on this particular sequence because the plan is we are doing tonight, if nobody has seen the episode artwork, we're doing Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs, which is going to be the first entry in our retrospective of Disney full-length animated movies. And we've already had some debate as to what movies that would include and which ones it wouldn't. I think we are looking to make it pretty much comprehensive, but there are a couple that may not fit the bill, and we're going to figure that out as we go along, and we have a lot of movies to cover, and we'll see how far we get. But I'm looking forward to this because I, and I'm sure my two fellow hosts here are, also big fans of the Disney animated universe, and, you know, this is a chance to rewatch some movies, and I don't know what your experience is, but I've had people who like say, well, that's a kid's movie. Why would you want to watch that? And it's like, no, but it's, you know, these are good. You know, I want to watch them. These are entertaining. They're made for all ages as far as I'm concerned. And for the most part, that's true in my opinion. I do think there are probably some exceptions which are really made for a younger audience, but I think these are made for a younger audience, but they're also made so that the adults who are taking the children to the theater to see them are going to enjoy them almost as much.
I think Walt Disney summed it up best when he would actually take it as something of an offense when people would label his films as children's films. And I'm paraphrasing, but he often would say something to the effect of, I don't make movies for children. I make movies for everyone. And I think that's kind of the secret of his success, particularly with his animated films, is that he didn't dumb it down. I mean, there's some examples I'm sure we're going to end up talking about in this film where, because I think kids are a little wussier today than they were, you know, generations ago, that this film has some bite to it, some things that would genuinely frighten a child. So I think that right there says this was never intended to be just kiddie fare. Can children enjoy it? Oh, absolutely they can, and they have for generations. But this is a film for everyone. I think that's borne out by the fact that it was a huge, huge success in its day, and that audiences sobbed for a cartoon, and that's something that had never happened before. So I think that's pretty powerful stuff, but we'll get into all that as we go.
Well, I'm going to just touch on now, this movie is subject to multiple re-releases in the theater, over a period of time where, you know, inflation has gone wild and everything, but listed on Wikipedia, the budget is $1.5 million, which is a phenomenal amount of money to have spent in 1937 to make this movie.
Yes.
The box office is listed as $418 million. I'm pretty sure 400 times your production costs is pretty much considered to be a hit.
I saw that as well, because I briefly perused the Wikipedia, and I'm very curious where they're pulling that number from, because, yes, that's phenomenal, but I'm thinking adjusted for inflation – this movie has got to be one of the top grossers of all time. So $418 million actually sounds quite low to me.
Well, if you think about it, again, adjust for inflation, $1.5 million to make it is probably the equivalent of a $100 million movie now. And $418 million, now they would have to adjust that over time. They'd have to say in 1937 it made this much and we're going to adjust that. In the re-release in 1947 we made this much and we got to adjust that. And they'd have to do it for every re-release. But I would guess that this would have to be well over $1 billion.
Oh, yeah. Yeah,
and,
easily.
And, you know, I mean, well over. So, you know, I don't remember what the record is now, which I believe is back to Avatar when they re-released it. But it's not a lot over $1 billion, and would imagine this would be. So this, you know, adjusted for inflation, this might be certainly one of the top grossers of all time.
Absolutely, yeah. I would expect it's right up there with, you know, Gone with the Wind and some of the others that you would have to do to play the same numbers game with. Absolutely.
The fascinating gamble about that when you talk about the money aspect of it and what it costs to make, because there's certain points in time where they reference like I've seen different documentaries that like the employees were awarded $5 for coming up with gags and things like that in order to create it, and that $5 was like the equivalent of like $86 today or something like that. So it was a big deal, but you add that $1.5 million or whatever it was to create this into that whole factor, that's huge. But also, this is a film, the labor of love of this, the fact that his belief in this, he bankrupted the studio in order to make this happen. I mean, this literally was do or die. They barely were able to get this thing out. And it was funny listening to a quote how, you know, they barely got the film to the box office and then it made profit. And he was able to pay everything off and become solvent again, and then had like a couple million in the bank. But then, like a couple years later, something like that, he was like $4 million into that again for the next gamble that he took. It was such a fascinating way to talk about passion.
You can't minimize the risk that he took, because an animated feature in the United States was unheard of at this time. You know, animated movies, as far as I can tell, were meant to be the filler that you put at the beginning before you actually showed your feature. And to, you know, for the first time ever to come up with an animated feature and expect people to say, well, I'm going to go see that. You know, that's the equivalent of saying, I'm going to go and see, you know, an hour and a half newsreel.
Yes.
You know? And you know, that, yeah, that was the risk that he ran, and that's a huge risk, especially if he's bankrupting the studio to do it.
Yeah. You know, it both amuses me and annoys me by turns, the kind of the modern layman perception of Walt Disney as this multi-millionaire, multi-possibly billionaire mogul who was just all about the money and blah, blah, blah. I think, you know, if you look at the history of him through his life, he wasn't really solvent until pretty close to the end of his life.
Yeah.
His whole professional life was a series of doing exactly what he did with this movie, which was going all in and risking everything on a dream. And you see that with Snow White. You see that with Disneyland. And there's some other things I'm forgetting, I'm sure. But yeah, it, continually doing that over and over. So yeah, and this, at the time this happened and everything, this was probably his biggest risk. I mean, he took other risks later, you know, again, Disneyland, but this was probably the biggest one. This one, if it had failed, as it was predicted to do, this was called Disney's Folly in many of the trade magazines and that sort of thing. If this had failed, I don't know that people would really, other than animation nerds, would really remember Disney today. This would have been the end for him.
Well, and then, as I understand it, and Scott, I know more of the history than me, I've heard that at the time this was made, Fleischer Studios was running neck and neck with Disney Studios.
Yes.
And, you know, they made Gulliver's Travels. And what I'm trying to figure out is, were they racing to the finish line to get this out before Gulliver's Travels, or was Gulliver's Travels made in response to this?
Now, here's where I run the risk of getting really beat up by somebody that might really know animation history much better than I do. But my understanding is that kind of gets whitewashed a little bit. Disney, now I'm talking Disney the company, Disney the entity, modern day Disney, is very good at kind of glossing over things in their history. Google CV would sometimes. It's a very amusing story. So, yeah, I've heard that, too, that, you know, definitely if you look at the animation of the day, the only other rival that really stands close to Disney was the Fleischer Studios. And I've heard that, too, that one of the reasons, you know, Disney history says that the reason Walt did this was that he just figured this was the next logical step. Plus, he was kind of running out of innovations. He had, you know, he was the first one to put sound to cartoon. He was first one to really add personality and music, as far as like music you could, you know, sell a record to animation. He was the first one to put color to animation. And he was the first one with the multiplane camera to put depth and real three dimension to an animated cartoon. So this was kind of the next thing. He was running out of innovations. What more do you do other than, okay, let's lengthen the cartoon. Let's take it from being, you know, the filler at the, you know, before the movie, to being the movie, to being the feature. So that's what Disney history kind of says. But I have heard that before, that he also was very aware that, you know, somebody else was either had come up with the same idea or was kind of nipping at his heels. It would have been interesting, I think, you know, in some sort of alternate history to see if, you know, what would the world be like if Fleischer had beat him? Because Gulliver's Travels is a great movie, but it's pretty much forgotten today, and it is in the public domain. So, you know, it's out there. You can see it and view it for free and that everything like that. It's at least last I knew. But it doesn't hold a candle to Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs. It is very dated in a way that I don't think Snow White will ever be. I think Snow White will always have a great timeless quality too. I mean, this movie's, I forget when it came out in 37, but for all intents and purposes, it's going to be 87 years old this year. That's that's phenomenal, because it doesn't feel that old, at least not to me. It you know, and it can still appeal to you know, to modern audiences and everything the same way it did way back when. I don't know that Gulliver's Travels has that same power.
Well, I'd like to throw out to you guys, I know we have so many movies to do in this project, but as the prime competition, I don't really mind the idea of maybe making Gulliver's Travels our next one in this retrospective.
I was actually thinking about pitching that idea myself, so I'm glad to hear that you're open to it. Yeah, I wouldn't mind, because, you know, animation-wise, it's pretty incredible. It really, I mean, it's very close to a Disney, and of course, you know, you look at the Fleischer Supermans, which to me are that's the height of the animation power of the Fleischer Studios, is that, but Gulliver's pretty darn good, and it holds up pretty close to that as well. I think where Gulliver is a little bit weak, though, is in the Lilliputians. They're a little too cartoony, which, thankfully, I don't think Snow White suffers from that. You know, the human characters like Snow White and the Queen and the Prince look like what they're supposed to look like. They look human, but the cartoon, you know, quote-unquote cartoony characters of the dwarves aren't so cartoon that it clashes, and I think Gulliver does. I think Gulliver versus the Lilliputians, they clash animatically, if that's a word, you know, if you know what I mean, you know, thematically. But anyway,
Gulliver's out in 39, by the way, 1939.
Right.
Oh, okay. So they were further behind than I thought that they were. Okay.
But it's possible that was in the planning stages, and Disney just, mm-hmm. you know, ran and said, I got to get this done. And again, you know, there's different people obviously hear different stories, and we may never know what the real truth is on that. But I grew up with Gulliver's Travels. I remember seeing Gulliver's Travels at least once a year. It might have been around Thanksgiving or so, but at least once a year, maybe more than that. And I remember watching it. Now, Snow White is a different animal, because I always remember Snow White being in my life, but I don't know if I ever saw it from beginning to end until the 1980s, when I was able to get a bootleg VHS copy of it, because the Disney Studios refused to release it on home video until the 1990s. So I'm not 100% sure I ever saw the entire movie before that. But Gulliver's Travels, I can tell you for a fact, I saw many times.
Well, I was hoping you were going to do your typical, you know, tell us your first story.
Well, that's where I was going, where I gave you my first story. So you take that ball and run with it.
So I think, like you said, I think I must have seen at least bits and pieces of the movie. I don't know if I ever saw it start to finish, but I probably saw bits and pieces, probably on like Wonderful World of Disney or something like that. But I did eventually get to see it, quote-unquote, theatrically. So the story with that is, for whatever reason, and I guess it's just because I lived in the sticks as a kid, when Tron came out in 1982, I wanted so bad to see that movie. I was a huge fan before ever seeing the movie. I got the story of record, and I listened to it to a point where I memorized it. I was just seriously into that movie. Yet it never came to our area in the year that it was released. And I was so bummed. I really wanted to see that movie. So the following year, suddenly there's an ad in the local paper. The Black River Drive-In is going to show Tron. And they had this huge ad. It wasn't like a full page, but it was a huge ad in the drive-in, you know, in the movie section of the paper. Tron in huge letters, you know, playing, you know, such and such night or such and such weekend. Oh, and by the way, second feature, Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs. So I begged my parents to take me to Tron. I was so excited. So we go to the drive-in, and we're sitting there, and, you know, it finally turns dusk, and, you know, everything's ready, and the movie starts and everything. And what comes up? Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs. Now, I'm 15 years old and a boy, and I was crushed. I'm like, you've got to be kidding me. I've got to suffer through this stupid cartoon, this stupid kid movie, you know, to get to Tron. So it's one of those instances where I really wish I could time travel back and slap my 15-year-old self and say, hey, pay attention, you know, this is your golden opportunity to see this movie huge in a way that you'll never see it again. I really don't remember paying any attention to Snow White. I think we just, like, because there was other kids with me, I think we just goofed off and played and basically, like I say, suffered through Snow White waiting for Tron. So it wasn't until sometime later, and you're right, it was in the 90s, but I forget exactly when in the 90s Snow White came out on VHS. And I was working in video sales at the time, and it was huge when that movie hit on VHS, because that was the first time where you could actually own this movie. And it was massive. And it was that phenomenon of sales, but also coupled with, okay, now I get a chance to actually see this, pay attention to it, and try to figure out, like, why is this being, you know, why is this such a phenomenon sales wise? And that's where I started to kind of learn more about it. But honestly, it wasn't until actually going to work for Disney where, you know, I started to learn about the history of Walt and the company and animation and all that, where that's where everything kind of clicked, like, okay, now I appreciate this level, or this movie rather, on a completely different level, beyond just the fact of the story and that I think it's, you know, it's a really good animated movie.
Just quickly, I was trying to look while you were talking to see when Snow White first premiered on television. And it's not easy to find something definitive. There's a website here. It's something, it came from the media basement. And it lists Disney movies and says the following are the premiere dates of the Disney classics on U.S. television. And it says that Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs was first shown on television on March 6th of 2010 on ABC Family and March 20th, 2010 on the Disney Channel. So that would mean unless you went to the theater to see it as a young boy, you never saw the whole thing. And that would say, in all likelihood, unless my parents took me when I was very young and I don't remember it, I never saw the whole thing until it came out. Again, I had a VHS bootleg in the 80s. So that would be the first time I ever saw it from beginning to end. How about you, Sean?
So it's actually almost completely parallel with both of you. Growing up as a kid, I watched Wonderful World of Disney. I know I saw sequences of it because they showed sequence of it on there. I had the book and record set as a kid. I was big on book and record sets and absolutely loved it because it was, you know, the art from the film and that type of thing that was in it. I vaguely feel like I did see it before it was released on VHS. Just because of the fact that I guess I always assumed that I did, but that's where I'm at with it. Just to piggyback off of what both of you said about it being released in video, it was such a great era when it originally came out on video because the Disney Vault was a very, very real thing. And if you're any kind of collector, it was such a cool thing to know that Snow White's coming out and there's a limited time to get it. And if you get it, you're going to have your copy of it. That also, with VHS, for those listeners that maybe didn't buy VHS or maybe are you too young, you know, to really have delved into VHS, you were also very protective of that VHS because VHS had a tendency to get caught in the player. And Snow White was one of those where I was like very, very protective of putting it in the machine and playing it because it was one of those that eventually went back into the Disney vault. And nowadays it's so easy to get things digitally and stuff like that, that it's, you know, kind of that mindless piece of that time. But it was fun. It was fun. It came out and it was such a, at that time, such a clean copy and being able to really see this movie and enjoy it. I felt like I was seeing it for the first time if I had not, only because seeing so many of these sequences in their entirety at a time in my life where I was really an invested fan was really, really awesome. The VHS era just was sweet.
Yeah, it's, and I remember, you know, when this came, when I first obtained my bootleg copy, and I was working in Manhattan at the time, and, you know, on every other street corner, there was some vendor who was selling, you know, bootleg VHS copies of the latest movies in the theater or whatever. And I remember seeing this in, you know, on the, they have the blanket laying on the floor with a bunch of tapes on it, and I saw this, and I think they would charge you like $10 for a bootleg copy of a movie, which by the standards of the day was much cheaper than it would cost you in a video store to buy a movie. And I remember getting it, and, you know, I was not a parent yet, but I was an uncle of several nieces and nephews, and I was so excited to be able to have it so that the next holiday that all the kids were over, I'd be able to put it on and have them, you know, like enraptured by this movie. And then, you know, I got it home and I put it on, and I remember being totally caught up in it. And I think that's probably our cue to just discuss the movie itself. And the one thing I could tell you that jumps out at me on every viewing of the movies of this era from Disney is the level of attention and detail and just, you know, clearly there was a love of what they were doing. And especially for some reason to me, when they show water, it just really jumps out at me, like, you know, like how great the animation is in these things, because this was a cell by cell animation thing that they would do. This isn't computer generated in any way. It's just phenomenal to me how they would be able to just put this all together. And, you know, it was clearly a labor of love. And I could just imagine in that day, you know, to be a Disney animator must have been just like one of the greatest jobs, you know, where you get up in the morning and you just love going to work every day. And there's so few jobs that could fit. And that's what I always think of when I watch this, and when I watch Pinocchio, and when I watch Sleeping Beauty, or any of the movies of this era. And you know, just watching this again for the first time in a few years, I was glued to my TV screen. You know, when they're in the forest, and when they're in the mine, and when they're in the house, just all the details and all the attention to, you know, the depth. And I think that's one of the biggest things. And you mentioned that, Scott, that, you know, that was a Disney innovation, to put that depth to these cartoons. And you see it, and it just, it feels like it had more of a 3D quality to it than the live action movies of the day.
Yeah, definitely.
I encourage people to pause this film. If you haven't ever taken advantage of doing that, pause the film at certain set pieces and marvel at the backgrounds. Because to the point of the multiplane where we're dealing with the three-dimensional that we're talking about here, Disney brought in artists, like top-tier artists, to create the sets. I mean, we talk about sets nowadays in live-action films and where they take place. He actually had artists come in and create sets for this. And there's multiple layers of animation that's put on top of some of those set pieces. Some of the sets are breathtaking. The castle sequences when you see them. The dwarf's house. The interior of the dwarf's house. If you've never paused it and taken a look at the fine details on the walls, on the furniture itself as you're going through. I mean, they did not shortcut anything on this. This really was designed from the ground up at a time where they had nothing to compare it to be a masterpiece. And it really is amazing when you look through certain sequences and go, oh my gosh, look at that chair. I mean, the ornate nature of that chair. It's in there for such a short sequence, but that chair, just like, you look at that and it's like, wow, that chair itself is just an amazing piece of artwork. It's really something that's very worth doing on this film, just because it's breathtaking, really breathtaking.
Absolutely. Yeah. Some of those backgrounds that are painted for this and some of the other early Disney animated features, some of those backgrounds are like museum worthy pieces of art. I mean, they're just so incredibly lavish and detailed, and it's stunning when you think about it. You know, that this was done for a cartoon, especially if you've grown up, you know, like us, in the latter days of anime, you know, like TV animation, where it was just so slapdash, you know, where you'd have an animated character that, like Fred Flintstone, that would run and you'd see the same tree go by 15 times because they were just recycling a very short, you know, sloppy piece of animation behind him just to show speed or just to show that he was traveling. when you go all the way back to something like this, you know, the golden age of classic animated films, it is stunning. It is mind blowing. The work and the labor and the time and love that went into, you know, these sets, some of which you don't really even see for much time at all, for all the work that went into them. And, you know, as Paul said, just, you know, this is one of those films, much like Fantasia is one that I always point to, for people that seem like maybe they don't have enough respect for animation. Watch this or watch Fantasia and constantly remind yourself while you're watching this film that there is no computers, you know. No computers were involved in the making of this. It was all done by hand. You know, there were no shortcuts. There were no tricks. There were, you know, there was no, you know, cycling things through a Xerox machine or anything. You know, this was all somebody sat down and drew everything that you're seeing. And when you have that mindset going into a movie like this, It you'll walk away stunned. You'll walk away going, holy cow, wow, what a work, you know? So it gives you new respect.
My first question, and I don't know, you know, just anybody listening, we don't really discuss what we're going to talk about in advance because we want the conversation to be pretty fresh. So I don't even know if either of you has an answer to this, but my familiarity with this story is based on the Disney production. And I'm wondering if either of you has enough familiarity with the Grimm Brothers version of this to know what differences what things they changed.
I don't know so much about changes. I know that the dwarves were never named until Disney made this film. So the names of the dwarves are Disney's names.
And if I can interrupt you on that, I think that's a brilliant thing to do because it automatically gave each dwarf a personality and you knew what the personality was and you didn't have to go into a lot of scenes to show it. So again, brilliant as far as I'm concerned. I'm sorry to interrupt you. Keep going.
Oh, no, not at all. I'm trying to remember. There's a children's fable or children's fairy tale, or I should say classic fairy tale, that the difference between the film and the original is that the villain woman, whatever she is, the witch, the evil queen, whatever, is given red hot scalding shoes and made to dance to death at the end. And I can't remember if that's Snow White or not, but I know that there is that story that's out there. And of course that would be a huge difference between, you know, this and that. But I can't remember if that was Snow White or not. But the big one I can definitely remember is the dwarves. The dwarves are, of course, you know, were always part of the story. But in this, they were given names. They were given distinct personalities. And it's really funny if you ever get a chance to look at the special features, you know, in either the DVD or the Blu-ray version. The list of names that they went through to settle on the seven that they did is quite amusing. I mean, it's every, what is that, adjective? Every adjective that you can possibly think of was considered, and it's quite funny.
You were mentioning the extras. One of the other extras that has to do with the dwarfs that I saw was the animators. They kept documentation of their conversations when they were storyboarding out these characters, really fleshing them out, not just what they were visually going to look like and what their clothes were going to look like and their overall appearance, their mannerisms, the way they spoke, the way they carried themselves. It's incredibly interesting. There's a big focus on the characters of Doc and Grumpy and Dopey in particular, just, you know, how they were fleshed out. And it's really marvelous to see what depth they went into to craft these characters as fully realized three-dimensional characters. It was neat.
I think they also did a really good job at making them visually different from each other, which is not as easy of a task as I think it seems on its face. I think on its face you think, well, big deal, you get seven different, you know, looks. But they're, you know, the seven dwarfs, so they're going to all be about the same height. They're going to all be working together, and you know, they're all going to have the same animation style. So it isn't quite as easy to give them all a personality in the way they appear. So the names give them the personality, the appearances give them a personality, and then there's just enough in the script that you see each one of them enough to really feel like you know the seven dwarfs. As a young kid, I think, and I get the feeling that this is a common thing. As a young kid, Dopey was my favorite because he was the funniest one. And as a grumpy old man, Grumpy is my favorite because that's the way I would be if I was a dwarf. So, you know, I think it's kind of fun to watch them and all of that. And I apologize to all the very woke people out there, but I'm really disturbed by the fact that this new live action movie has decided that, oh, we don't need to have the seven dwarfs anymore because that's not politically correct. I'm sorry, but I don't think there's anything insulting about these characters. I think they're wonderful.
I do, too. I tried to settle on, because I kind of wondered if this would come up as a topic of conversation on our favorite dwarf. I couldn't settle on just one. I narrowed it down to three, and a lot of it's just based on either a line of dialogue or just their demeanor, and that was Happy, because Happy, I feel like, of all the dwarves in the movie, he's the one that kind of gets shortchanged. He doesn't get a lot of scenes. He doesn't get a lot to say, but I love his introduction. When Snow White first wakes up and she sees them and she's doing the guessing game to figure out, okay, which ones match the names on the beds. When she gets to Happy, she doesn't even get a chance to say his name before he goes, "Happy, ma'am, that's me." And I just, there's something wonderful about that. That's just, it just charms me. It's so sweet. And that's him. I'm Happy. And I like that. I like Bashful, again, just for his nature. He, like Snow White, is very sweet. And I like that in his personality. I love when the dwarves are headed to work, and he's the one that shows, honestly, the most concern for her safety. And he tells her, you know, be careful. And he starts to say something to the effect, you know, if anything should happen to you. And so you can tell, you know, he genuinely cares for her. And then Grumpy, but not for the reason you might think. I mean, yes, I'm amused by, you know, he is a curmudgeon. He's much like we are at our age and everything. But where Grumpy really wins me over is he takes her death the hardest of all the dwarves. And that scene busts me up every time when they cut to him and he stands apart from the other dwarves sobbing in the corner so that they can't see him. And that, I mean, it literally makes me cry. And there's not a lot of movies that do that, but that does every time. It really hits me that she, you know, because she says that little prayer when she goes to bed that one night, you know, please make Grumpy like me. And you see that he came to love her, and it really hits him hard.
The best part about Grumpy, too, is his journey. Because at first, you know, he starts off as, you know, very gruff, but when they're all going to work that day, and they're all, you know, she's kissing them all on the forehead, and we got the funny little Dopey sequence that's going through there. And I always, as a kid, Dopey was absolutely one of my favorites. And Doc being a close second, as being kind of like the de facto, quote unquote, seemingly leader / spokesperson of the group. But Grumpy, you see him there when he's kind of like straightened himself up, even though does not want any part of this. He supposedly. But when he goes out there, then kind of fumbles the whole way afterwards and has his little funny moment. But when he is the one that, when he realizes she's in danger, all pretense of how we know Grumpy completely drops.
Yep.
He's not Grumpy anymore. He is now he's the leader. He is rallying everybody. They're all following him. He's got everybody riding on in. It's a very, very different character. All business. It's all about getting to her. We've got to rescue her. And it was a completely different organic mannerism that led to his journey. I couldn't agree with you more when you're saying at the end, man, I get choked up with how he was feeling in that. But I think that's because his journey is so cool to watch. and appreciate now, because I don't remember when I was younger thinking of Grumpy that way. I think it's something, as I've gotten older, I've gradually kind of grown to appreciate the fact that this character has a heck of an arc.
Yeah, he's probably the best defined of the dwarves. At the front of my house, I have a 1 foot Grumpy that stand there, and he's holding a sign. It's like a wooden board that says "Welcome" on it, but then over "Welcome," it's got in paint "Go away."
So. Well, you know, Paul, that one of my personal criterias for if a movie is Jaws or not is quotability, and Grumpy gets all the best lines. There's a line that he says that I often quote to my wife, you know, just to kind of, you know, get her goat a little bit. And it's where he says, she's a female and they're full of wicked wiles. And one of the other dwarves says, "What are wicked wiles?" He goes, "I don't know, but I'm going to get them." I love that line. It's just great.
Now, I would personally be very upset with Snow White if I came in the house and found out that she was cleaning my dishes by having animals lick them. But, you know, that's just me. I'm kind of picky that way. But, you know, I mean, again, the animated sequences when she comes into the house and when she and the animals are all cleaning the house. And it's just wonderful. It's just the whole sequences and just the animation, the dust and the dirt and everything and how they get it cleaned up. Just great stuff. And then, now this movie, by the standards of the day, is incredibly long for an animated feature because it's 83 minutes. But when you compare that to movies, to feature-length movies, that's a very short running time. It may be just a little below average for the day because I think at that time movies were generally shorter than they are now. But there is a lot of development in this movie that is done through showing you things in some sort of sequences, you know, whether it's a montage sequence or a, you know, a little thing that goes on. But I think they do a really, really good job. I'm going to give you one that they do a really, really good job and one that I think it fails a little bit for me. They do a really, really good job of showing why the dwarves come to love her so much. I think, you know, the scenes that they show with her and them when they first discover her, and then when they're dancing together and all of that stuff, and then when they leave for work and everything, like you could see the affection and you could see how the affection built so quickly. So I think that's excellent. The one thing that I do have a problem with, and it's more of a storytelling trope of the day, is I'm not a big fan of the love at first sight thing that they do in these movies, that she met this prince, you know, the one time and that's it. She's stone in love with him and that's it. And, you know, it's, you know, not for nothing, but if I came across somebody who I did love and they were laying there dead, I don't know if my first instinct would be to kiss them, but you know, whatever, that's, you know, I'm curious as to what you guys think on both of those, the positive and the negative.
I'm glad that you brought up the thing with the prince, because I did rewatch this for this recording, and that was one of the things that I got to thinking about was choices they made in the story and how it's told and how it's edited. And I think overall, I think it's paced very well. I think they did an excellent job of, as you say, making you fall in love with Snow White the same way the dwarves do, and understanding why they do and why they come around, especially Grumpy. The only sequence in the entire movie that I feel like, okay, that runs a little long, is the washing up sequence for dinner. That is the one part of the movie where I don't want to say I can get bored, but I can get a little bored. I can kind of hit the fast forward on that sequence a little bit because it does play a little long, because taken as a whole, that entire sequence from when the dwarves come home to the silly song, that's quite a chunk. I mean, that's a solid chunk of the movie. And it just needed to be trimmed a bit. What's funny is that they'd already trimmed it, because there was actually another sequence in there where the dwarves eat the soup that Snow White has made. And that scene did not make it into the movie, much to, oh gosh, now I can't think of a name. It's a classic animator. He was gutted that it didn't make it in, but I'm blanking on his name. But where I felt like they were savage in the editing to the detriment of the story is the prince. And it's funny you bring up the, you know, the whole love at first sight and everything, because something was nagging me today at work as I was thinking about this movie. I'm like, am I remembering this right? Isn't there more to his story? And so I dug this book out, and I know we're an audio medium and not a visual medium, but I have this book I got some time ago. It's called The Disney Comics, and it's Disney Comics, the Classics Collection, and it's a beautiful hardbound book. I can't remember where I picked it up, but in here is a reprinting of the comic book adaption of the day of Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs. And sure enough, the prince has a heck of a lot more to do with the story than we would ever realize by just watching the film. To a point where, you know, he actually gets locked up by the queen. So he's kept from Snow White. And that's something that, sadly, I think is important, and it's missing from the film, is making you understand that, okay, he climbs the wall, he sees her, they have their moment, they both fall in love, and then he just kind of disappears from the narrative all the way to the end of the film when he shows up and gives her love's first kiss. And you're like, if you think of, if you actually stop and think, because the movie moves so fast, you don't really get time to think about it. But if you stop and think about it, you're like, wait a minute, that doesn't make any sense. Where did he go? Well, there, he had a whole adventure. He had a whole adventure that just got excised from the movie that we're just sadly not privy to by the film alone. So that hurt the narrative in that way of, if you think about him, then it doesn't really seem to make a lot of sense. But it's strange because for 87 years, I think people haven't really thought much about him and haven't really caught that narrative gap.
It's funny that you mention that, and now I'm sitting here and my mind is kind of going crazy a little bit, because that sounds so familiar to me that maybe it might be that I read that comic adaptation as a kid at some point, and that's why that's in my mind. But I'm also thinking I may be mixing it up a little bit somewhere in my mind with Sleeping Beauty when the prince is trying to get to her.
Right,
so I'm
right.
Not sure, you know, I wonder now that I'm, you know, with my mind confusing the two a little bit, I'm wondering if that was Walt Disney saying, you know what, this is the one, you know, this is one of the things that I think was a weakness in Snow White, and I'm going to rectify it in this movie. I wouldn't be surprised at all if that's the case.
They are incredibly similar stories.
Ward Kimball, by the way, was the animator.
Ward Kimball, thank you. It was driving me nuts. Yes, thank you, Ward Kimball. So yeah, he ended up getting rewarded on the next film, on Pinocchio, with, you know, given the choice assignments on that, because Walt felt bad to cut that soup sequence after Ward had worked so hard and so long on it. He put in like a year or something on that sequence, only for it to wind up on the cutting room floor, which is really sad. But
I get it
now. I'm sorry.
Can I share a sequence that really stuck out for me this time?
Sure.
Because it really surprised me, and I don't remember being struck by it. So in the woods, when she's escaping the huntsman has just spared her life, right?
And I'm going to interrupt you just to say, I was going to just mention how the huntsman's whole sequence is so wonderful.
Yes.
That in a very short time, you understand why he's coming after, and you understand why he can't do it, and it's so good. No, sorry, go ahead.
No, where there's depth to this film, this sequence was amazing. Her mind was playing tricks on her. And I mean, we're talking about a very early era of being experimental with anime. I mean, this is the first animated feature where we were taking this kind of depth to it. The tree branches become like fingers grabbing at her. Logs look like alligators. They weren't alligators. They looked like alligators. The trees seem to have eyes. Facial expressions and physical motions that she was going through, you know, knowing that these are these multi-layered animation cells, all hand-drawn. I mean, this was all hand-drawn to make this happen. This is a girl who was almost murdered, finds out the queen's out to get her, and that nowhere's safe. And this, then it ends with like this overwhelming crashdown of reality on her. This was captured in like this amazing sequence where she crumbles into this point, and then it, you know, Flitch just gradually goes to this brighter sequence where the animals kind of enter the scene. But I was just stunned by that, because at that era, to take that level of depth where you're showing what's happening in the mind playing tricks on her, happening in real time for us as the viewer to go through that. It was just a stunning, stunning sequence. I don't know why this time around it struck out for me. Sometimes you just kind of focus on different things. This right. time that sequence hit, I was just following every motion she went through. And I don't recall ever doing that to the level that I did in that sequence. And that one just stuck out for me this time as just being an example of another brilliant sequence in this film, which is so much a key of how this was shot. So when you reference a sequence like that, that is how they put this together. And I think that's why it has the depth that it has, because of the fact that this was constructed this way.
Yeah, I agree with you.
I love that sequence. I know exactly the sequence you're talking about. At Disneyland in California, the original Disney park, they still have Snow White's Scary Adventures. Sadly, the Walt Disney World version doesn't exist anymore. But that was always my favorite sequence of that ride, was when you would go through the scary part, you know, the part where she was in the forest, because that ride for the longest time didn't have Snow White in it, because you, the guest, were supposed to be Snow White reenacting her journey through the movie. But unfortunately, so many guests didn't get it that they finally put her into the attraction. But that sequence, going through the woods and seeing the alligator log and seeing the scary trees and the branches that are fingers, I loved that. Even as an adult, I could see where, oh my God, this had to be terrifying for a kid, you know, which is why they added the word scary to the title of it, because it was scary. Mm. I've often wondered, knowing how influential this movie was to MGM and giving them the confidence to go ahead with Wizard of Oz. And I think Wizard of Oz, honestly, I think borrows very liberally from Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs. I've often wondered if the apple trees that, that throw apples at, Dorothy and the others in that one sequence, I've often wondered if they're kind of borrowed from this forest sequence, because they seem to be very similar kinds of creatures. But I don't know that for sure.
Interesting.
But I
always like that. Very interesting thought. I'm not sure. But, you know,
I'm sorry. I like that you mentioned the Huntsman sequence, though, because that might be my favorite section of the early part of the movie, because I don't know when the dwarves fall in love with Snow White. I don't know when the rest of the viewing audience is supposed to fall in love with Snow White. That's where I fall in love with her, because up to that point, you know, you've seen her at the wishing well, you've seen her interact with the prince and everything, but this is the moment where I think you get to the core of who she is. And who is she? She's just a sweet young girl. And I love the part where she's tending to the little baby bird and talking to it and being very kind for this lost little bird. At the same time, behind her is building this menace of the huntsman who's going to put a knife in her. And I love that juxtaposition and that entire scene. And I like that he can't do it. And I've often wondered, can he not do it because of some moral thing that's in him, or he can't do it because he sees the same thing? He looks at her and says, she's just a sweet girl, and I can't murder her. I don't know, but that's the instant where I fall in love with that character too, because she's just sweet.
I've always taken that scene as being that he is perfectly capable of killing. He can't yes. kill her because he sees the innocence in her, and, yes. and he just can't bring himself to do it, because the people he can kill are people who deserve to be killed in his mind.
Yes. Yeah, that's kind of how I see it too. And the end of that sequence that Sean was talking about, where she kind of breaks down in the woods, I've often seen that given as an example why, you know, for people that don't like her or don't, I don't know about liking the film, but don't like her as a character, that see her as, you know, outdated, and she's a cream puff, and she's not, you know, she's not Princess Leia. And I get that, but she's not supposed to be. She's supposed to be exactly what she is. She's a sweet, young, innocent girl. And in that moment, she is completely overwhelmed by her situation. But where I will defend her is that what's the very next scene? The very next scene is her picking herself up, dusting herself off, and going, she even has the line of dialogue, "I'm so ashamed of the fuss I've made." And she picks herself up and says, "You know what? It's going to be okay. I'm going to make it through this." And she uses her mutant ability to talk to the animals to be taken to the dwarf's cottage. I love that. I think that's wonderful. So I really chafe against people that want to portray her as some sort of cream puff or something. I've heard her, I mean, some really negative things said about her, that, you know, her voice is cloying and all these things. But I don't see it that way. I find her very sweet and very charming.
I do as well. And I do have some extent where I'm willing to say, to a small extent, that she's a character of the time. This is 1937, so the style of her hair, the voice of, you know, that they chose for her and all of that is going to be made for the standards of that time. And I think, you know, you have to kind of accept that. But even with that as a thought, this is pretty much a timeless film just the same. The only things about it that I do think have a little bit of an element of the era are what we just said, and then certain things in the music that I think are a little, you know, I think they would be done differently if the movie was done 20 years later.
Yeah.
The one thing that strikes me about her too, this time around in particular, is this is all about beauty, right? Who's the fairest of the land? In her case, her beauty wasn't just like this outward shellac that was kind of over her. It was her whole character. Her encounters with the animals, her encounters with the dwarves, her, even the huntsman, the huntsman kind of recognizes she's just this really kind person. The prince, every encounter she has, she is a kind, genuine person. Like, she doesn't have like a second personality. It's kind right. of just kind and helpful and wants to, you know, just treat people well. The old woman, when she comes to the cottage, you know, the animals are treating her very poorly. Snow White's like, this is a guest, and I am going to treat a guest with a certain amount of class, a certain amount of character, a certain amount of kindness. She takes people as, forgetting what they look like and all that, she takes people as, this is an open doorway to somebody who could perhaps be a friend. That works against her a little bit.
Yeah.
But the mirror... Yeah. The mirror clearly isn't taking her internal beauty into account, because nope. The mirror is willing to say that the queen is the fairest in the land until a certain point, and she's obviously got no internal beauty.
Right. I love that scene. Work too.
I love the animation on the mirror, by the way. I think that's wonderful.
I love... I highly encourage anybody that doesn't already have this in their collection, I would say... this is going to sound really weird, but you need to own it in two formats. You need to own both the two-pack DVD that has like a bluish, purplish cover on it, because that, the special features, many of them are introduced by Roy Disney, Walt's nephew, and they're really worth owning and going through all the special features on there. But also the Blu-ray release, just, it looks fantastic. But the reason to own both of them beyond all that is the magic mirror is your host and does, like, when you choose the different options, whether you're going through like chapter select or whatever. And some of his smart ass comments are so wonderful and so on point. I don't know who voices him, because I'm sure that actor is long dead, but they nail it. And it's very, very funny. Because I put my Blu-ray in, and Mirror actually commented on how long it's been since I've watched Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs. He said, "Welcome back, it's been," and he quoted it. And I was like, oh my gosh, that's so cool. I thought that was really neat. But that sequence you're talking about with the beggar woman, I interpret that every time I see the movie, I'm struck by the moment where the birds like attack the beggar, you know, the old hag. And when Snow White actually comforts her and starts to kind of guide her, you know, pick her up off her feet, the look that she has it for just a moment, it seems like she actually had a change of heart. Like, she, you know, for just a moment, she saw that beauty in everything in Snow White as well. Now, it doesn't change her. She still carries through on her evil plan. But I love that moment, just that look on her face, like she cares for me, even, you know, in this horrible guise and every, you know, she still is who she's pure to herself. And I love that moment.
It's also one of the sequences, if you watch it back, Snow White is almost an eye shot of her. Snow White can see her. And if you take a look where the eyes are, it's not taking anything away from you. Just said, I'm just adding another little layer to that.
Right.
The animators put in little details of when Snow White could see her, she had a certain man. And then when, like, just the animal, she could care less what the animals see. It was because she did. She, like, her scowl came back and stuff when she was looking at the animals.
Right.
And to the point of, like, the animators being really cognizant of direction. And we talk about details and how they use the characters and even directions that the characters were facing, what they were seeing and how they were reacting to what they were seeing was really revolutionary for this one. This is the first one out of the gate. I know they've done lots of animation before, but in shorts, when you're developing and putting all this together as one big long feature, to put all of those details in and have them flow to create this larger sense of character and narrative is, we take it for granted now, but what they were doing at the time is something that it held up. This was gripping to watch.
But I got to think that attention to detail, the choreography of not just the dance sequences, because that's what people think of when you think choreography, but the choreography of, you know, this character's moving to here, this character's moving to here at the same time, all of that's attention to detail. I think you got to credit Walt Disney for making sure that was done the right way. And I think part of it is because of the gamble he was taking. I think because of the risk he was taking, it was like, this has to be perfect, and I can't take a chance that there's going to be any little hole in it that's gonna, you know, that's gonna screw it up. And what I mentioned earlier about one of my, you know, minor criticisms of the Love at First Sight, I think that was a common film trope at the time, and I don't think that, you know, in 1937 people really would have had an issue with that at all. So I can understand why in that era that they'd let that go. I just, you know, I have accepted some of the arguments of, you know, these fairy tales making, you know, girls think, oh, I'm going to just sit back and my prince is going to come. So I, you know, I don't know that that's a good message to send to young children. But, you know, be that as it may, I don't think it's a true problem with the film. And I think that the attention to detail shows not only in the animation, but also, as I said, the choreography that goes into the animation.
Although I could make the strong argument that she was trying to eat a magic apple to make her prince come, and it backfired.
Oh, because she did say that yeah, it'll make your biggest wish come true or something.
Right.
Yeah. Any other sequences that are worth mentioning?
I like that one with the apple, because there's a very famous clip, a film clip of Walt laying out the story for his animators, and he embodies the witch and her mannerism. Everything with the witch is taken from Walt's enactment of the story. And there's a great film out there of Walt doing this, you know, holding his hand out like the witch does, going magic wishing, and you can see it in his face. I can't remember if it's silent or if it has sound to it or not, but you can see, and it's the same mannerisms, it's the same facial expressions and everything. And I love that. I love the animation in that moment, because it's you're seeing him reflected in that, because that was his enactment, and that's exactly what the animators went with. I love the Evil Queen. I think she is one of film's greatest villains. I think she's fantastic in this. I love that it is the same voice actress for both of her incarnations, for as both the Evil Queen and the old hag. And I love the old hag's voice. She's got just this wonderful, wonderful voice. And I think it's great.
Do you know how she achieved that voice?
No.
She took her dentures out.
That's wild.
It's actually true. She thought that would give more of the sequence. I was watching one of the feast special features, and that came up. I never knew that. This was something I actually just discovered today. And I was sitting here like, oh my gosh, that is so cool. To piggyback on what you're saying though, when she's the queen, very striking presence.
Yes.
Because when you've got this queen who's sitting there saying that she wants to be the fairest in the land, she has a presence to her that is something that is very iconic, that is very, very striking. And it shouldn't be discounted when you talk about just how well-crafted Snow White was as a character. The queen is pretty critical to be something that is memorable, striking, at least stands out as being something that you just have it's a very unique feel to that character. There's something about her that you don't forget her when you've seen her once.
No, and I like that there's just enough given in the story to make you understand that she has a power and that she's feared, because on one of my viewings of this a long time ago, I kept thinking Snow White is the princess and she's the daughter of whatever king ruled this realm. Now he's gone. Why do the people allow the queen to treat her the way that they do? And I think that's solved story-wise by the fact that she is an intimidating and fearful creature. Because the dwarves say, you know, the dwarves know who she is, and they say, you know, she uses black magic and all this. So she's feared in her realm. And that just adds to her mystique and adds to her power. And I think that's very cool.
Wait, moral of the story, you go and visit her and she invites you down to her basement. Do not go. Because that place was pretty darn creepy for that time as well.
She's got some of the best animation in the film, too, I believe. I love the sequence where, the prince is wooing Snow White and we cut to the reaction of the queen in the window. And I love that shot of her standing there holding and just the scowl and the hatred on her face is it's powerful. But I really love the animation when she's the hag. I just the movement is so fluid, and you kind of forget when you're watching her that you're watching a cartoon, because she just might be the most realistic animated character in the whole film when she's as the hag, especially when she, after she, you know, quote unquote, kills Snow White, and she comes out the door of the cottage and realizes that the dwarves are on approach, she like looks around and then hightails it. And that piece of animation is so smooth. It looks so good. Because that's one of the things that often bugs me to this very day with animation, in general, is when characters run and it just doesn't look right. Mm. Like their feet don't fall right and their movement doesn't look realistic because your brain catches it. But she's perfect. Her animation is just absolutely perfect in that sequence.
They filmed subjects for this too. I mean, that's one of the things they did. They filmed animals. They filmed they had a girl that was a model that they for the purpose of getting like realistic motion and things like that they filmed. Which is something that helps with the attention to detail as well.
Absolutely. Just kind of looking over my notes. I had so many notes, but we have covered. I've often wondered what was the queen's plan beyond the death of Snow White. Was she so vain and so into this that she sacrificed herself, her beauty, to do this? Or did she plan to change herself back?
I was always of the mind that she could change herself back when she chose to. And she had a fitting end, let's put it that way.
Yeah.
When I was rewatching it, I kind of forgot. I wasn't sure. I was like, you know, do they just chase her away, or does she actually get killed? And I was kind of happy that it was the way it was, that she, when she falls off the ledge. Yeah, you know, I thought she could turn back.
I'm pretty sure those vultures, the way that they were swirling around her afterwards, turned her into a Lunchable, because that was it was pretty clear what they were, that they had ill intent.
Yeah, I think her plan was just, you know, she'd get rid of Snow White and then she'd go back to being the fairest in the land.
Yep. Yeah, and you talk about dark. I mean, that's there's no mistaking she's dead, and as you say, now she's going to be a meal for the vultures. I love that the animation in that sequence. There's a couple different scenes with fog that just look so beautiful. When the vultures descend on the body, they go into fog and eventually become obscured. But also when the hag is making her way through the forest to the dwarves' cottage, there's a couple of sequences that happen in heavy fog. And it just looks, I mean, so incredibly realistic. And that's another thing I really like about this movie is that in many, many ways, this was the final Silly Symphony because this was the culmination of everything they learned, all the tricks of the trade that Walt's animators learned from the skeleton dance all the way until this film. And I love that. In the history of Disney, I've always loved when they did something, whether it was a film or whether it was a theme park attraction, where you can tell for this moment, we're throwing in every trick that we've learned up to this point to create this thing. And that's exactly what Snow White is, that it was the culmination of all their best stuff. And it really pays off.
I've never heard anyone really call it the final silly symphony before, but it's so true. I mean, that's really cool. I like the way you're coining that.
Now, I already mentioned a little bit with the score that I felt like just a little bit of the music felt a little dated to me, but overall, I thought it was quality for the time. I thought it was, you know, kind of the style of the time. It didn't really strike me as in any way negative, but I do think it was one of the things that could kind of date the film a little. I don't know, you know, I'm curious as more of a connoisseur of scores as to what you thought about it, Scott.
Yes and no. I mean, it definitely, you know, when you listen to it, you can tell it has some age to it. You know, you can tell it's not a contemporaneous score. It's one of those that I've often wanted to hear someone go back and what's the word? It's not rescoring, but where they take an old score and they reproduce it. There's a word for it that I'm blanking on. But over the years, certain scores have had that treatment where someone would go back and reproduce it. And I'd kind of like to hear that with this, you know, reproduce it new for this generation to kind of expand the audio quality of it, if you know what I mean. But they did a pretty good job of that. The Blu-ray that I have of it is a 7.1 sound mix. And rather than take it and, okay, this speaker is going to have a bird and this speaker is going to have a dwarf and this speaker is going to have, you know, this or that sound effects stuff, what they really, to my ear, what they really did more than anything was that they took the score from being, I'm assuming, mono and blew it out to the 7, you know, and really using that space. The problem is that you're taking an 87-year-old tape and doing that, and you can only stretch that so far. It sounds great, but it still kind of shows its age. So I would love to hear it faithfully recreated. And I know that there have been some film composers that have done that with some scores, you know, over time. But yeah, this one, I mean, it gets a big old pass for me because much of the work that was done on it was by Paul Smith, and I adore the guy. I love everything that I have of his that I, you know, that he's done. And there's a whole bunch more stuff that he scored that I wish that they would put out there. So on one of his albums, I forget which one it is, but one of his albums that I have, I think it was one of the True Life documentary albums or something like that. But one of his score albums, the last couple tracks on it, he did medleys of some of the early Disney works. I know Snow White was one, Pinocchio, and I forget what the third one was. That medley, while it's still at this point several decades old, it's newer, a newer rendition of Snow White, and it sounds fantastic. So, but yeah, I think overall it's a really good score. And just the fact that just about every song in the film has become, you know, a timeless classic that, you know, people still sing today, that are still played, you know, at the theme parks today and that sort of thing. Thank goodness. I can't think of anything in this movie that has yet fallen victim to, you know, political correctness, or, you know, to where somebody wants to ban it or whatever. That would break my heart if that ever happens. I know that there's sequences in the film that are now considered, what's the term, problematic or whatever. I kind of shake my head and laugh. Hopefully that'll never come to anything serious to where, you know, somebody tries to alter the film or ban the film or whatever. But I don't know. You never know the way things go these days. But I look at it as, you know, as what it is. I think it's a timeless, wonderful classic. It's not only a wonderful slice of, you know, of its time, but I think it holds up, and I think it stands pretty tall even today. I think you know, young people can still discover it today and fall in love with it and never even realize how, you know, how old it is.
Now, I'm sure this movie has got references in a million different places in media and different things, but I feel like I would be remiss if I didn't mention my favorite reference to it, and that would be in the movie Gremlins, when the evil gremlins, after they become evil, they take over a movie theater, and then they have the main character on the phone, and he's like, they're watching Snow White, and they're loving it. And it was the whole hi-ho sequence. Yeah. And I just thought, you know, that just brought a huge smile to my face. So I thought that was great. And like I said, I'm sure there's a bunch of other points that if I searched it out, I could find. But that happens to be my favorite one of those.
I scored Gremlins on Blu-ray from Goodwill, I don't know, probably a year or so ago, for an absolute song. And I probably had not seen that movie since it was on HBO, you know, back when I was a kid. And I had completely forgotten the Snow White sequence. So watching that again, and when it got to that part, I was just laughing and rolling. I thought that was wonderful, but I also was thinking, how in the world did they get approval from Disney to use Snow White in a horror film? But it works. It's brilliant, and I love that. Yeah, I'm right with you. That's a great sequence.
Yeah, well, we're big Gremlins fans here. We have a Shih Tzu, and his name is Gizmo. So, unless you guys have anything else, I think it's time to give a rating. I don't see how I could give this anything but a Jaws. I really, not only is it supremely entertaining when you watch it, but when you consider what a groundbreaker it was and how it paved the path for so many movies to come, it's not only totally entertaining, but it's historical on top of that, and it does not feel dated. And if somebody's listening and they have not seen this because they think, oh, well, that's a 1937 cartoon, so it doesn't interest me, please give it a shot, because I can't imagine that you won't be captivated by it no matter what age you are. You guys?
I would definitely say, to me, it's a Jaws plus. I mean, and I don't say that lightly. It's a masterpiece. There's the sequence that we talked about with the prince, where it's like, okay, the relationship between the two of them is a little shallow. You know, did not quite get the kind of depth of everything else. True, and that works for me too that way. I mean, as far as there's a couple of sequences that the music's of the time, but the difference between that and something that's dated to me is when something feels dated, it detracts from the experience. In this case, of the time is part of the charm. I feel like this film's iconic. There's so many wonderful sequences that are in this one. If you have not seen this, you have to. I think you give this movie a chance. And I would not dismiss it because of the fact that it is it's an older film. It's a masterpiece. It's like going through an art museum. It's if you enjoy that kind of experience, that's what this is. And do yourself a favor and go through this museum.
You know, and listening to, you know, getting caught up on the show and listening to some of your most recent episodes, you know, one of you guys had mentioned that, you know, there's not a lot of movies out there that are Jaws. There's not only not a lot of movies out there that aren't Jaws, but there's not a very, you know, there's not very many movies at all that you can say literally changed the world. And Snow White did in so many ways. It created an entire genre of film that continues today. It saved and reinvigorated the Walt Disney Company and kind of gave them a model to go by that they're still operating off of today, and kind of, you know, set that company's path to where they went on to, you know, to bigger and better and created, you know, Disneyland that, again, changed the world, things like that. So this is a very, very culturally important film. Now, that said, there's other, you know, quote-unquote culturally important films that I think are a snooze fest. This one's not. It's charming. It's witty. It's intelligent. It's fun. And more than anything for me, I find it quite moving, you know. I really am struck by the power of the film, and I can easily imagine what it was like to watch this movie in 1937, and you're laughing with it, you're enjoying it, you're amused by the dwarfs, and then, oh my gosh, that punch in the gut where she's dead and the dwarves are just destroyed by it. And audiences sobbed for a cartoon. And I think that just can't be understated and underappreciated. And I feel that when I watch this. And you know, so that really owes in heavily to my rating of, yeah, it's definitely Jaws. And it was huge for its time. I mean, it was kind of the Star Wars of its day. And rewatching it for this recording, it really struck me that at the end of the film, when she's revived and the prince sweeps her up and places her on the horse, and, you know, the dwarves are all excited and they start to go toward the castle and the music really swells, I get the same feeling in me, you know, that same glow and that same butterflies in my stomach feeling as I get at the end of Star Wars, at the very end of the throne room sequence where the rebels start clapping and Han gets that golly gee shucks expression on his, and you just feel good. You know, you're happy for that moment. This film has just really made you feel great about everything, you know, your life. And it just, there's not a lot of movies that have that kind of power. And that's why I really appreciate this one. It just makes me feel good after I watch it. Like, what, you know, you walk away going, what a sweet movie.
I agree. Yeah, couldn't agree with you more. So next time out on this particular retrospective, we're going to hold off on Pinocchio, which I'll say up front was my first Disney feature in a movie theater that I can remember. As a young boy, you know, when it was re-released at some point. But we're going to hold off and we're going to take a look at the distinguished competition, as Stan Lee would call it, and see what Gulliver's Travels looks like in comparison for the Fleischer Studios. So I'm looking forward to that. I haven't seen that in a long time. But I do remember being a big fan of Gabby, so we'll see. But in the meanwhile, thanks for making the time to do this with us, Scott, and I'm looking forward to many, many more animated features.
Well, thank you so much for having me. I really enjoyed this, and hopefully I, wasn't too much of a blabbermouth through it, but I love this movie. Genuinely love it.
All right, so that's a wrap, guys.
Oh, you must be grumpy.
Oh, did you hurt yourself? Goodbye.
Now I'm warning you. Don't let nobody or nothing in the house.
Why, Grumpy?